News in Columbia, this is Intersection, conversations in our community. I'm Sarah Shariari. In the wake of the 2016 presidential election, one thing is clear. Rural America and urban America see things differently. In this series of profiles, Harvest Public Media reporters introduce us to our fellow Americans and examine the issues that they hold dear. We rediscover the ties that bind us and learn more about the lines that divide us. And through these voices, we come to know Americans just a little better. Illegal immigration, refugee resettlement, the lagging rural economy, all issues that defined the 2016 election. As part of the United and Divided series, Harvest Public Media brings us to a place dealing with all of those complex issues, a rural high school with a rapidly diversifying student body. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon has the story.
Also remember to stop.
It's first period at the high school in Fort Morgan, Colorado, and I've posted up at a desk in the back corner of a classroom.
Hey, U.S. states and capitals.
I came to Fort Morgan because it's a small rural city, just 11,000 people, and it's minority-majority. Less than half the population here is white. At the high school, more than half of all students are Latino. And yet, the school is nestled in a farming county that voted overwhelmingly for President Donald Trump. English teacher Taylor Jordan moved to town a few years ago from suburban Denver.
From the highway and from the outside, it looks like just a typical small town, farm town. But then living here, just all the deep cultural roots that we have here, I think makes it such a special place.
Take this one class, ESL, English as a Second Language. Students hail from some of the world's most violent and war-torn countries: Somalia, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras. The first student I meet is dressed in a floor-length plaid flannel dress and a light pink headscarf.
My name's Isra. I am senior this year, and I'm 18 years old.
Isra Mohamud is a Somali refugee. She's a member of the city's small but growing East African population. I ask her to describe Fort Morgan to someone who's never been here.
It smells kind of bad, to be honest, but it's good. I like it. We have this company called Cargill.
Cargill owns a meatpacking plant in town. The surrounding county is also home to a growing dairy industry. It has a big sugar processing factory. For decades, immigrants have flocked to jobs here, and they've kept the agriculture and manufacturing economy up and running. Mohamud arrived in the U.S. when she was in the eighth grade.
It was so difficult for me. I couldn't understand what people were saying. It was totally different culture, different people.
But that changed when she got to Fort Morgan High, amidst a diverse array of students. She still stands out around town, she says, but she's at home.
There is people who are going to stare at you because they never saw someone who's wearing a hijab. And they're wondering what the hell's wrong with this person. But like most of people, like they don't even care. Like it's your culture, it's your thing.
Fort Morgan's cultural transformation has brought some tension. Muslims from Africa first arrived around 2007. And since then, police have responded to acts of vandalism. Religious disputes at the meatpacking plant flared up. Latino and Somali residents still say they sometimes get nasty looks when they speak a language other than English in public.
Community-wise, I think it was extremely difficult.
Ben Bauman is the high school's principal.
I think the community, there's some backlash of this other culture coming in, and not one or two, but hundreds.
There are formal efforts to integrate the various communities that call Fort Morgan home now, by the police, a nearby university, and a local nonprofit. But 16-year-old Kyla Carpenter says the high school is where the rubber often meets the road. To Carpenter, a Muslim refugee isn't an abstract idea. He's the person next to her in social studies. Undocumented students fleeing violence in Central America aren't just an image on the news. They're on the volleyball team.
Some of them try to, like,
avoid the issue of this is happening, because we go to school with people like this, and so we have to face it. We have to adapt to it.
Many parts of rural America are losing population. Fort Morgan has held steady or grown for years. Immigrants like Isra Mohammed made that happen.
People are always judging you, no matter how you are, no matter what you are, no matter your color. So you don't have to let them get you and let you down. You have to be strong and define yourself.
Mohammed says she likes living here and wants to stay and work after she finishes high school. In Fort Morgan, Colorado, I'm Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Rural voters overwhelmingly chose Donald Trump in the presidential election. But when it comes to one central campaign promise, getting tough on trade, rural voters are not always in sync with the administration. As part of the Harvest Public Media series United and Divided, Grant Gerlach went to a rural Nebraska town to understand voters' competing views on trade.
Farmer Don Beatty fires up a dusty freightliner hitched to a flatbed trailer. He's headed to pick up a load of hay bales, so I ride along. We rattle down a gravel road through flat farm fields in the Platte River Valley in Dawson County, Nebraska.
My great-grandparents came here 144 years ago from England and homesteaded just a mile south of where we are right now.
Beatty wears glasses and a green ball cap. He's 58, but says that makes him one of the younger farmers around. He and his wife farm about 1,500 acres of mostly corn and soybeans. They're raising more grain than ever before, but it's not paying off right now.
We'll probably end up losing money for the year, and unfortunately that's kind of the way agriculture goes. We have boom and bust.
I'm in Dawson County because, like most of rural America, Donald Trump won a big majority here, 70%. But it's also a good place to look at one issue where rural residents have different perspectives. That's trade. Don Beatty supports President Trump, even though he knows Trump's trade proposals could spell more trouble for the struggling farm economy. We step into a farm shed where he tells me what his business needs is higher commodity prices. One way to do that is more trade.
That is one of the concerns that I and many of my fellow farmers have with the Trump administration is what he's been saying on trade. You know, he wants to renegotiate the NAFTA agreement. He vetoed or canceled the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement.
Many voters saw the TPP as a path to outsourcing, but it would have made American farm exports cheaper in much of Asia. And then there's President Trump's campaign proposal to put big tariffs on Chinese imports. China is a huge market for U.S. farmers, so they worry about a trade war.
I am a free trader. That means that I think we ought to be able to sell our goods to other countries. They ought to be able to sell their goods to us.
But then on the other side of Dawson County, there's Junior Dishman. He likes where President Trump is going with trade.
I'll take you to the far side. We'll just go around. It kind of looks like a bomb went off right now.
Dishman is driving me to the edge of Cozad, a small city in Dawson County, to see what's left of the former Tenneco factory. He worked at the factory for 40 years, making shock absorbers mostly for car companies. Now it's demolished. A salvage company is combing through piles of bricks and insulation to pull out scraps of steel and copper. Dishman looks out from under his black cowboy hat and points out a landmark in the rubble.
There's a pile over there. I think the desk is still there with the keys still laying on the desk. They just knocked it down on top of it.
Like farmer Don Beatty, Junior Dishman voted for Trump. But those import tariffs that Beatty is worried about, Dishman thinks they could help American workers compete with cheap labor overseas.
If they do start charging, let's say, China and all them tariffs and things for bringing their product back in, the cost will offset and then they can get jobs back in here.
Dishman knows farming is the biggest industry around Cozad, but Tenneco was the town's biggest single employer. At one time, he says, 750 people worked here in a town of around 4,000. He says many young families followed jobs out of town. Older workers with deeper roots stayed.
But they had to take a hit in their wages and in the insurance, and it affected the town quite a bit. It really did. It was like a lifeline here. It was a heartbeat, I think.
He He doesn't want to see farmers suffer, but a lot of small towns have factories like this, and he wants to see them stay open. That's what makes trade policy difficult. Even when people here agree on most things, trade involves trade-offs that cut different ways through rural America. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
This is Intersection on KBIA, and today we're sharing Harvest Public Media's United and Divided series. I'm Sarah Shariari. Fleeing civil wars, gang violence, and ethnic persecution, migrants and refugees have transformed some small Midwest communities. In big cities and rural areas alike, changing demographics can be stressful. But as Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, churches in one Iowa town have different ways of helping all residents navigate change.
As Highway 30 enters Denison, Iowa, a city of 8,000, the national fast food chains stand next to Mexican groceries and restaurants. In this small city near the Nebraska border, waves of immigrants have been arriving since at least the 1980s. Recently, on a hot Sunday, parishioners at the English language mass at St. Rose of Lima exited the church to the sound of a live band and the smell of tacos and pupusas outside. Denison is the seat of Crawford County, where, as of 2015, more than a quarter of the people are Latino. Father Paul Kelly enjoys ministering to both the Spanish and English-speaking parishioners at separate Sunday masses.
You know, the cultures are different in terms of, well, in terms of food interests and Hispanic people like to celebrate more outdoors. They're more expressive. Music is a little more lively.
At fundraisers like this one, he says, he often sees a mix of both congregations. Maria Soledad Laura Rodriguez is selling cold bottles of water. She's lived in Denison for 10 years.
I feel safe because it's a very quiet town, and here in the church, helping, we feel good.
15 years ago, Denison had a brief, tragic moment in the national spotlight. 11 people looking for jobs in the large meatpacking plant boarded a train car full of hope, but lacking legal working papers. They were locked in and never let out. A rail worker found their bodies when the car was opened for cleaning. Today, the Latino community is well entrenched. Despite the train car deaths, many still make their way here, out of the poverty or violence of their homes in Mexico or Central America. And they land alongside refugees from Africa and Asia. They're all attracted to the long, hard hours of meatpacking work, which brings a steady paycheck. The churches here play an important role, but it's a tricky one. They want to help the town accept its changing identity, but also offer a place where people feel comfortable. They can be a connection point where different communities come together, but maintaining one's identity rather than shedding it to fit in is also important. Working through that struggle, 21st century immigrants in Denison, Iowa are just like every other newcomer to American shores. Pastor Mark Wallace doesn't want language to segregate his church. He came here in 2009, hired to revive a dying Baptist church.
They told me the community had changed. We had about 50% multi-ethnic. But the church was all white, all seniors, and that wasn't our community.
He committed to creating a multilingual and multi-ethnic congregation. He renamed it Journey Church and started working alongside city officials to help bring different groups together. Wallace says he sees a lot of fear among people who don't know each other.
If we can break down those barriers, then we're better off.
When the South Sudanese Lutheran Community Church gathers, men wear suits and shiny shoes or bright patterned African shirts. Toddlers race about the space that's also used by two other congregations, one largely white, one mostly Latino. Abraham Kamich left South Sudan and studied agriculture at a high school in Kenya. He's lived in Seattle and worked on fishing boats in Alaska. He says he came to check out Denison, thinking he could go back to the Pacific Northwest if he didn't like the work or community.
But when I met the people here in this place, they are amazing people. So I feel happy and happiest.
He works at the meatpacking plant too, and he likes being able to worship in his native language, Dinka. The desire for comfort and familiarity is going to split many people along linguistic or cultural lines, even in churches committed to embracing the changing communities they serve. And that's pretty much the same story, whether the community is a small town or a big city. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
This is Intersection on KBIA. I'm Sarah Shariari. Today we're sharing Harvest Public Media's United and Divided series. Schools in rural school districts often don't have the budget or the teachers to offer students all the courses they'd like to take. As part of the United and Divided series on bridging the urban-rural divide, Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted visited one rural district in Missouri that's trying to fix that problem.
Tucked away in Jefferson County in the eastern part of Missouri at the meeting of State Highway C and State Highway Y sits Grandview High School,
which is out in the middle of nowhere.
And Grandview Middle School.
Literally in the woods.
And Grandview Elementary School.
In a place where you can't buy a gallon of milk or a gallon of gas.
That's Matt Zoff, the superintendent of the district. He oversees about 750 students and 65 teachers. Half of his students qualify for the free and reduced lunch program. Enrollment is down, budgets are tight, and he has trouble attracting and retaining teachers.
We're the lowest paid school district, minus one K-8 district. So I'm asking my teachers to do a lot more on a lot less.
That means he may not have enough teachers for every course. Take physics, for example. Yeah, physics.
I may have two or three kids, because we're such a small school, that are interested in taking a physics course. So to offer physics on campus would be tough.
Think lab equipment, textbooks, and the limited number of qualified teachers in town.
But I can take those two or three kids, put them in a study hall and assign them physics, and they can take it online.
Online classes. The Grandview District teamed up with a private company to launch a virtual public summer school for its rural students to give them course options they don't normally see during regular registration. About 200 students enrolled the first year. Similar programs exist in Colorado and Iowa. The headquarters of Missouri's virtual summer school is just past the football field here in a building backed up against the tree line.
Right now, as you can see, I have like 17% that's high performing.
Elaine Schlett runs Missouri's virtual summer school program. Today, she's clicking away on her laptop to check students' progress. Three pie charts pop up on her screen.
I have 59 that's kind of iffy pacing risk because they consider speeding or going through it too quick or that. And then I have about 24% that's behind.
Courses include French 2, archaeology, and advanced placement calculus. Students can log in, do their required lessons, and interact with their teachers, all online. Some of them do it from home. Others, without internet, can come take their courses in the library. The courses count toward graduation, just like any other. And this summer, more than 1,300 students are enrolled. Now, students in rural districts across the state use it.
We almost double every year, enrollment-wise. I mean, we get them from way down in Walnut Grove to Eminence to anywhere in the state. You know, little rural towns you don't hear of very often. It's like, that's a new one this year, you know.
Superintendent Matt Zoff says people often have a misconception of the potential of rural students.
I think they look at the rural student as, kind of a hillbilly hick that they don't want to succeed. They don't want to take those courses, you know, because we're not going to offer, you know, what the Golden Ring in St. Louis offers.
Online classes are not a fit in all cases. There are questions about quality of the curriculum or the lack of face-to-face interaction with teachers, concerns about students absorbing the material and doing the work. But for his district and his students, Zoff says it's an option that gives them the best chance to succeed with limited resources.
Because there are so few teachers, there are so few students, and most of the time the schools can't offer the courses that everybody else has taken, so using them to compete, I think, is only fair.
Like any other superintendent, he's looking to give the kids in his district a new opportunity. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
This is Intersection on KBIA. Many immigrants here in the U.S. are worried that changes to immigration policy pushed by the Trump administration could impact their families. That's just as true in rural America as it is in cities. As part of the United and Divided series, Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon brings us to a rural community and introduces us to the immigrants who want to become U.S. citizens.
Good morning. How are you?
Marisa Velasquez welcomes a group of students to the public library in the Morgan County town of Brush, Colorado. It's about 90 miles northeast of Denver.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started.
It's a sunny Saturday morning, and today marks the halfway point in Velasquez's citizenship class. It's a 10-week crash course on American history, civics, and English.
Okay, Congress makes the laws in the United States.
Every student has the same goal, become an American citizen. And if you ask Velasquez, she's surprised to even be here.
And I never thought I was going to teach a class because I took the class as a student.
Velasquez has lived here for 15 years, but only became a naturalized citizen last year. She took this very same course in preparation for her final test. It's a series of questions about the U.S., a dictation exam, and an interview in English.
So that's where we get to practice listening skills, writing skills, reading, so that they're ready for when they go for their interview to become a citizen.
This year, Velasquez has 21 students. In a rural area like Morgan County, that's huge. Like a lot of rural communities centered around meatpacking plants and dairy farms, there are big immigrant and refugee populations here.
So we have students from Mexico, from Guatemala, El Salvador, and then he is from Ethiopia. So some of them are refugees.
There's a lot of fear in the community.
Lisa Prey is the only immigration lawyer in Morgan County. Since the presidential election, she's noticed more of her clients asking about citizenship. Usually, people would just come to her office when they had a relative back home they wanted to bring to the U.S.
Now, what I'm hearing from people is, I just want to make sure I get to stay.
When President Donald Trump began signing executive orders on immigration and international travel earlier this year, Prey says Morgan County's immigrant population was shaken. And while some fear still exists, it's acted as a motivator.
This is one of the big benefits associated with becoming a U.S. citizen. You can't be deported.
Mark Hugo Lopez is director of Hispanic research at the Pew Research Center. He says the number of people seeking citizenship typically peaks when the application fee is set to rise, or during an election year. In 2016, roughly 1 million people applied to be naturalized citizens, the highest in nearly a decade. But Hugo Lopez says there are still millions of eligible immigrants who are not seeking citizenship.
Now, many of them, when you ask them, will say they want to become one, but they also will cite reasons like not only the cost and language being potential barriers, but they will also say, for example, they're busy, they're working, they don't have the time, they haven't even thought about it.
Back at the public library, class is about to wrap up. In a span of 2 hours, instructor Marisa Velasquez has covered voting rights, the legislative process, grammar, even which month Flag Day is in.
Okay, Flag Day is in June.
This week's homework is to study up on amendments to the Constitution, all 27 of them. Another question on the citizenship test. I chat briefly with one student, Kibram Baraki, a refugee from Eritrea. Like every other student, he's already a legal permanent resident. He works at the nearby meatpacking plant, hanging cow heads for hours each workday.
Why did you sign up for this class?
Because it's almost I'm coming in America. It's 5 years. And that's why I take a class. After I did a citizenship, I get a great job and a good life.
Get a great job and a good life. Baraki says that's the opportunity America has given him. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Thank you for joining us here on Intersection, conversations in our community. And of course, thank you to Harvest Public Media for sharing the United and Divided series. If you'd like to listen to this show again, visit us online at kbia.org. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where we're at Intersect KBIA. Our music is Montana Skies. Our producers are Abby Ivory Gagne, Elena Rivera, and Hannah Haynes. I'm Sarah Shariari for Intersection here on KBIA 91.3 FM.